Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talked to Stephen Bush and George Eaton about the Chinese Premier's visit, the tax credit row, and Corbyn's new spin chief. Then Tom Gatty talks to William Boyd about John le Carré's new novel. It's been a big week in British politics as we have rolled out the reddest of red carpets for the Chinese Premier. But there has also been trouble behind the scenes with a vote on tax credits and a maiden speech in the House by a Tory MP in which she took on the government's policy. I'm joined by George Eaton, our political editor, and Stephen Bush, editor of The Staggers. George, first of all, you've written your column on China this week. And you've made this theme about the idea that we kind of currently talk about kind of Europhiles and Eurosceptics, then we're going to have the same discussion about China in the future. Why is that? What's changed?
I think this is the first British government that has had an overarching sort of coherent engaged strategies towards China, and it's very much a positive one. George Osborne and David Cameron have explicitly said they want Britain to be China's best partner in the West. They want Britain to be one of the most open economies to Chinese investment. And that means there has been a downgrading of human rights. The issue is of much less importance for the government than it was under the coalition, and even more so than it was under Labour. There have been £35 billion worth of deals. Perhaps most significantly, China's taking a one-third stake in Britain's new nuclear.
This is Hinkley Point C.
That's right, and so of course Britain now has a lot more at stake in its relationship with China than before, and people are responding to this, and it cuts across left and right. So Steve Hilton, David Cameron's former director of strategy, proud free marketeer, has been one of the most vociferous critics of the stance the government's taken. Then, of course, you've got others on the left, such as John Ross, Ken Livingstone's former economic advisor, who teaches at a university in China and who's been a Jeremy Corbyn supporter, criticising those who've been emphasising China's terrible human rights record by saying, look, it's pulled more than 700 million people out of poverty. Isn't that a real achievement that we should be celebrating? And so I think that And this is going to become a much more significant dividing line in British politics. And it feels as if we finally caught up with the reality that China's the world's second largest economy. It's likely to overtake the US at some point in the near future. And our position towards China is really going to be far more significant in some ways than our position towards Europe.
And Stephen, there was an unfortunate kind of piece of optics, I think you would say, this week. The steel factory in Redcar is shutting down, and that's going to lead to the loss of more than 1,000 jobs. One of the reasons that's been given for that is because China is heavily subsidised its steel industry. It's dropping very cheap steel onto the market, and other people can't compete. So at the same time that you have Cameron Osborne lauding Chinese infrastructure building in Britain, you have the spectre of the fact that they won't protect companies and jobs in Britain. I know Laura Kunzberg at the BBC asked a question about this. Is there anything that they could have done for that steel plant that they should have done?
There's lots they could have done. So the government line is in the EU means that you can't intervene in steel because overproduction of steel has been a consistent bugbear of the European economy. But as the Italians and the French are both saying, you can talk about environmental protection, you can use lots of opt-outs in a way that allows you to protect it. I personally think that they should have done so because there's this idea that is very prevalent in wonk circles and in the top of the Conservative Party, this idea, we'll move up the value chain. Well, China wants to move up the value chain and away from dangerous jobs like steelworking. So Britain is going to be competing with China on steel as well as on
IT jobs, like
tech, software. So you need to have a broad-based economy. And it also will devastate a large chunk of the Teesside economy. It is, I think, a hugely short-sighted mistake. And also, the reality is, whenever we talk about retraining and reskilling, we are uniquely bad in Britain at reskilling 40-something. So what we basically mean is, don't worry, kids, your parents will be unemployed. You will struggle to get by, but we'll teach you how to become a programmer. It doesn't really work. But George is exactly right. The kind of China question is going to be sort of one of the live issues of British politics. In fact, the odd thing is we talk a lot about how, oh, what can the Labour Party learn from Canada or America or Europe? But the interesting thing is these arguments have very similar echoes across African democracies, where Chinese investment and the kind of strings which come attached to it has been a live political issue basically in every African election since about the year 2000. So it's going to be interesting to see if some of those arguments start to become ballot box issues in the same way.
And I think it's been a big week domestically too with tax credits. So Heidi Allen, who is a new Tory MP, stood up and said, you know, if we're compassionate Conservatives, we should be against this. It was quite a stirring speech, particularly so since, you know, there is a feeling that this is George Osborne's baby and he's got the party pretty well disciplined. George, but he's not for turning, is he?
No, he's not for turning at the moment. Although I think the chance of a modest U-turn, modest readjustment has increased. So I think the autumn statements, which is on the 25th of November, is the moment everyone's planning for and awaiting. And he would have the chance to take up, for instance, the proposal that Frank Field, the chair of the Work and Pensions Select Committee, has made, which is to ensure that the lowest earners, those earning below £13,000, wouldn't lose out. And he's proposed the way in which you could adjust the taper rates and the thresholds to ensure that it wouldn't cost the government anything. And that is crucial, of course, because one of the reasons George Osborne is making these cuts, of course, is so he can meet his target of a budget surplus by 2019.
The one thing I think is really interesting about this is that for the first time, I think Osborne's lost the story. I'm not getting for them at the moment is the story of why they need to do this. Because I think, you know, having watched the sort of rhetoric around austerity, well, there was very much presented as we need to tighten our belts, otherwise we'll end up like Greece, you know, this is what we need to do. Bedroom tax, you know, this was a kind of, we need to make work pay, we need to kind of, you know, what I don't think he's nailed with this is, I think everybody just thinks this is just a mean thing. I mean, and no one seems to be buying his rhetoric about the idea that the minimum wage will eventually compensate, and actually it just seems very free market at the expense of working people. I mean, is that different? Have there been other circumstances where he's done that before?
I think the problem they've had is they obviously announced the living wage, essentially a higher minimum wage, to give them some political cover, and initially gave the impression that no one would lose out, that this would directly compensate them. In fact, of course, immediately after that, the Resolution Foundation and others pointed out, look, there are going to be people who lose out no matter what. And the Treasury and ministers are now tacitly admitting that, or even explicitly admitting there will be losers. I think, actually, the government would have been better not to pretend that there weren't losers, which is the mistake that Gordon Brown made over the 10p tax rate, but to say, yes, there are losers, but you know, we have to reduce the deficit. And if we don't cut tax credits, are we going to cut schools and hospitals? Mm-hmm. And perhaps Labour could propose what they'd cut, or at least where they'd raise taxes, which is essentially the argument that they used in the last Parliament, and which, of course, didn't work too badly for them since they got a majority.
Yes, I think an echo of therefore what New Labour did as well, which is that they always kind of said, well, this is how many schools you could pay for this, you know, putting it in those real terms. Stephen, I just want to come to you about Michael Meacher, who is the veteran MP who died this week. He's a towering figure on the left of the party. His death also means a by-election in Oldham West, his seat. He has a pretty thumping great majority, 14,000, but UKIP second, and then the Conservatives very quickly behind them. Is there any possibility that Labour might lose that by-election?
Yeah, I'd say there's a 1 in 10 chance that Labour could lose the by-election. Demographically, although it looks quite different to the neighbouring seat of Heywood and Middleton, where obviously UKIP came within about an inch of taking the seat from Labour.
600 votes, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was very small.
It was very close. And then as now, so UKIP during that by-election was distracted by the fact that they had a much more winnable fight in Clacton at the same time, so they put no effort into Hayward and Middleton. UKIP at the moment is doing what they seem to do after every general election, which is collapsing into infighting, this time over the in-out referendum, which obviously is their big cause. Labour staffers in their field team are quite nervous about it because it is a fairly UKIP-friendly by-election, and Labour's UKIP problem has got worse since Corbyn was elected, because basically under Ed Miliband, Labour was losing votes to the Greens and UKIP, and they weren't really sure whether or not they were going to try and stop the hemorrhaging from the Greens or the hemorrhaging from UKIP, and in the end they kind of did a bit of both and didn't work very well. What Corbyn's election has basically done is that has completely stopped the hemorrhaging to the Greens. In fact, the Greens have been knackered by Corbyn. The problem is that's come at the expense of accelerating the UKIP problem. So in some seats, the net gain in votes will be to Labour's advantage. The fear in seats like Oldham West is that the loss to Labour far exceeds the gain. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
And finally, I just want to pick up an appointment that Team Corbyn have made this week. So we've had the launch of Momentum, their new group, which is big news. But also they've appointed finally now a director of communications, which is Seamus Milne, the former Guardian columnist, who is actually going to be on leave from the Guardian. George, this was a controversial choice, and I think probably people who work in the media sort of assume that everyone would know why it was a controversial choice, whereas people in the wider public didn't.
Well, it's a controversial choice because Seamus Milne has been writing columns for The Guardian for a long time and has often taken positions which, to put it mildly, a lot of people disagree with. So he defended what he described as the Iraqi resistance against British and American troops following the 2003 invasion. He's often defended Putin against Western critics. He said that the Soviet Union's record is nowhere near as bad as people suggest, and praised a lot of the gains that were made under its leaders' views, which are sort of not widely represented in British politics. And that's the reason that he's got the job, essentially, probably closest to Jeremy Corbyn's position. And people often say, you do need someone in that job who you can trust, who understands your positions and can make the case for them. The criticism that will be made is, of course, Jeremy Corbyn's missed the chance to appoint someone who had wider contacts.
Yes, or somebody with broadcast ability, for example, which I think that they feel is an important way of going over the heads of papers who are very partisan. Stephen, you published a blog on the Staggers, which was really interesting, from John McTernan, who did a similar role for Jim Murphy in Scotland. Now, he's controversial for almost exactly the opposite sense of, for reasons really, for being very much seen as being very much on the right of the party. But his advice, nonetheless, was quite interesting, I thought.
Oh yeah, the advice, if you haven't read it yet, I strongly urge you to check it out. It was very generously expressed. It was, I think, very good advice about the importance of strategy, which is the main part of Milne's role. John McTernan has excellent political instincts. He understands message discipline, all of this kind of thing. And it may very well be that Seamus Milne has a similar gift for it. But right from the beginning, because John had been in, he'd been a commentator for ages, he'd been out of the political game for so long, he had become part of the story. In some ways, it's a lot like Peter Mandelson, who has undeniably a lot of skills as a strategist. But Peter Mandelson is such a huge figure in his own right now that you can't really have him as your...
He crowds
out the message. And that is kind of the Milne problem. Partly because, I think the line which I suspect the Conservatives will throw back at Labour is him saying that the murder of Lee Rigby was not terrorism in a conventional sense. And basically, the Conservatives want the next election to be about terrorism. Governments fight one of two elections. Don't let the other lot ruin it if they've done a successful job of it. I doubt the Conservative government will have done a successful job of it, so that message won't be available. Or don't trust the other guy. And they already have this Bin Laden quote that they are using slightly out of context. But the dispiriting thing for Labour is that even if you quote it in context, it's more reasonable, I think, to most metropolitan liberals, but I don't think it's any more reasonable to the average voter.
And I think, as Rob Hutton from Bloomberg said, I think the Conservatives would be delighted if Labour spent the next five years arguing about Jeremy Corbyn's attitude to Bin Laden, right? It's, explaining is losing in that one.
Yeah, and I think, in general, the interesting generational split within the Labour Party is obviously, you know, we forget that Corbyn and Blair are roughly the same age. So they're both politicians who came to power in a largely print-dominated era. So they hired a lot of print journalists. Ed Miliband hired two print journalists. Most of the print media is never going to give the Labour Party a fair hearing. They would be, I think, much better off with someone immersed in telly and radio, and they'd maybe do a big set-piece interview in the FT, The Guardian, The Mirror, and perhaps even The New Statesman from time to time.
I also think there's an interesting point about depriving you of one of your best sort of advocates on Fleet Street, because, you know, since Corbyn's election, Seamus Milne has been one of very few columnists in Fleet Street who's welcomed it, you know, wholeheartedly. He's been, you know, he's very much interested in the project. You know, he was a very strong voice. He was actually, you know, and I think that John McTernan picks this up in his piece, is that he's now no longer to have, you know, he's not allowed to have those opinions anymore. So where he was doing one kind of friendly task for the Corbyn campaign and its ideals, he can't do that anymore. And actually looking around the papers, I think that people who are Corbyn supporters do have a real grievance, more actually I think than SNP supporters who feel that the media is against them, because actually there are really very few people who are sympathetic to Corbyn, whether or not they're sympathetic to broader left-wing aims or that sort of strand of thinking. To him particularly, he has very few allies in the press, and one of them has now been sort of disappeared to go and work backstage, basically.
Yes, and in some ways, one MP said to me, a Brownite MP said, the problem with Ed Miliband's press team is he recruited two of their most sympathetic journalists to work in his operation, and they said, well, they didn't gain anything to make up for what we lost by not having them on the other side. Also, I mean, PR is a very different job. I mean, you have to say please all the time. That's why I'd be a terrible spinner.
And not have any opinions of your own, Stephen.
Yeah.
On that terrifying note, I'll say thank you very much to George and Stephen.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And together we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously.
This week, we talked about women at the front line of feminism. We looked at the new film Suffragette, E4's new comedy Chewing Gum, and Kim Kardashian's book Selfish.
If this sounds like something you would enjoy, you can find this episode and everything else we've done on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Gatti, I'm culture editor of the New Statesman, and I'm on the line with William Boyd. Hello, William.
Hi there.
William Boyd has written us a terrific review this week of John le Carré, the biography by Adam Sisman. This is a long-awaited biography of le Carré, unauthorised, written with cooperation. What's the score there, William?
I think it's written with cooperation. Adam Sisman says in his introduction he has spent more than 50 hours talking to John le Carré. So that, as far as I can see, that's pretty much an authorized biography. Certainly he didn't try to prevent him. Mm. So I think we can assume that this is pretty much the story as le Carré would have liked, though Sisman is also at pains to stress that, you know, he didn't have any remit, or there was le Carré wouldn't tell him things he didn't want him to know, but that Sisman was not kind of writing to order.
Because it's sort of on the public record that for a while Robert Harris was slated to be writing a biography of le Carré, and that seems to have just sort of quietly fizzled out.
Yes, I think what happened was that Robert Harris passed the torch on to Adam Sisman, so this in a way is the biography that Harris would have written, but I don't know why he decided he wouldn't do it. Maybe it was just too much like hard work, but anyway, Adam Sisman is an excellent biographer, and so I think it was a kind of mutually agreed handing on of the task.
One of the most interesting things that emerges from this biography, certainly from the piece that you've written about it, is Le Carré's relationship with his father. What sort of man was he?
Well, he's an extraordinary man, I say in the piece, an almost mythic figure, sort of con man, millionaire. He mixed in the upper reaches of society, and then the next month he'd be in jail for bankruptcy and embezzling. So he's an extraordinary, fringe society underworld figure, an impossible man, clearly. And in a way, somebody whose presence until he died completely haunted Le Carré, not surprisingly. He really is a character out of some astonishing, Grand Guignol novel of his own right. And Le Carré has written about him before. In his novel The Perfect Spy, there's a very clear Ronnie figure. And also he wrote a long memoir of his father in The New Yorker some years ago. So he has been trying to exorcise the demon. But this biography really gives us the whole story, and it is extraordinary.
And is there a sense of what, as well as, putting him in some pretty tricky situations and tricky and conflicted situations growing up, is there a sense of what effect that relationship with his father might have had on his later life? Does Sisman speculate in that way, or is this a very sort of cut and dried, leave the interpretation up to the reader type affair?
Well, I think, Le Carré, as he got older and was married and became successful, sort of cut himself off from his father, quite ruthlessly. I mean, they did see each other, but it's significant that he didn't go to the memorial service of his father when he died. So I think it's in his early 30s, he made a decision that, he was not going to have anything more to do with Ronnie. But I think, psychologically, there's no doubt that he must have had a huge effect on Le Carré as a young man. The massive insecurities of the kind of life, the rackety life he led, the social embarrassments that occurred, this kind of dark, semi-criminal figure haunting your life. Le Carré was enlisted by him to do all sorts of slightly shady jobs, negotiating with hotel managers in Switzerland, delivering packages to rich widows in Paris. And as a very young man, it's another extraordinary thing, in his early 20s, he was leading that slightly glamorous, semi-criminal, shady life himself in Saint Moritz and Paris and gambling holidays in Monte Carlo. So there's a whole, shady side of being Ronnie's son that must have had a huge effect on the way Le Carré evolved as an individual. And then once he had his own independence, he cut him off.
And you talk in the piece about you make a comparison with Le Carré's interest in chronicling his time, his instinct to point out injustices leads to a sort of comparison in his writing with Dickens, but actually, and thinking about his father especially, his life had some curious parallels with Dickens's, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, that was the first thing that struck me, that Le Carré's childhood, if you didn't know it was Le Carré's childhood, you'd think it might have come from a Dickens novel, this, abandoned as an infant, his mother left home and Le Carré was five and he really had nothing more to do with her. And so Ronnie took over the education, but having this sort of semi-criminal, gangster figure as your father, and then leading that, again, that shady kind of life in his doing his bidding, is the stuff of fiction. But then it struck me that you could extend the parallel, and that in a way Le Carré's novels are Dickensian in the sense that they are chronicles of our time, or of the Cold War, the late Cold War. And Le Carré's style and his love of slightly Dickensian names, etc., make it seem valid in a literary sense as well as in a biographical sense.
Another thing that comes out of the book, I think, is just how, and we talked about this earlier, just how establishment Le Carré's upbringing was. As you say, boarding school, Oxford undergraduate, Eton schoolmaster, army officer, foreign office diplomat. And it reminded me, there was a recent biography of one of the Cambridge spies, Guy Burgess, by Andrew Lowney, which described a similar upbringing and painted a very evocative picture of a man who sort of clung to his old Etonian tie all his life as a badge of identity. Now, Le Carré had a slightly different relationship with those institutions to that. What were his feelings towards those institutions that shaped him?
Well, I think he was suspicious, and he didn't fit in, even though on the surface he looks, you know, absolutely prototypically a kind of rising young man within those kind of ranks. And he himself has said, and I think in his fiction has explored, the fact that, you know, he might just as easily have been a double agent as a spy, that these, our traitors, our famous five, as it were, were all highly privileged, well-educated young men, but they chose to work for the Russians. And Le Carré was exactly like that, but he chose to work for MI6. But he's aware of the kind of blurred line between being on the MI6 side or actually, you know, going rogue and turning against the society that shaped you and nurtured you. That's the great sort of intellectual fascination, I think, of our traitors and our double agents. It's why did these people with silver spoons in their mouths turn against their country? And I think that we'll continue asking ourselves that question for a long time to come.
Absolutely. And he's writing in a time where a lot of the sort of sheen and glamour of that part of society is rubbing off. And again, that I was struck by the picture of Guy Burgess, you know, in his slightly shabby suit in Moscow. These imperial elite establishments were sort of crumbling at the edges, weren't they?
Yes, and I think it is the end of empire as well. That's the interesting thing, that all these young men were born at the apotheosis of the British Empire, if you like, in the 20s and the 30s, and saw it collapse, and saw the half the map that was painted red slowly return to other colours. And so there's a sense of empire ending, and you see that slight decadence arrive throughout history, that it provokes a kind of insecurity and a kind of self-analysis that often ends up being destructive.
As we're in the slightly sort of feverish moment just before the release of a new Bond film, and indeed, as you've written a Bond novel yourself, I wanted to ask what intersection there might be, if any, between Le Carré's and Fleming's work.
Well, I think that on the level of the novels, there is a slight intersection, but there's no doubt that Fleming's novels are fantasies in a way, and that Le Carré's are thoroughly rooted in this slightly seedy, you know, day-to-day business of being a spy. So there is a gulf between the two writers, even though they're both, you know, notionally spy novelists. Also, it has to be said that Le Carré is a far superior writer, technically, than Fleming. But the two men are interesting in that they're both privileged and slightly tormented, and they would both be familiar absolutely with that upper class world of spying and clubs, which is in a way classically Bond. But I don't think, apart from that, there is any real crossover between the two worlds.
Is it fair to say that Fleming's approach is more celebratory and fetishistic of that world than Le Carré's?
Well, it is. It's interesting. The more you look at Fleming, the initial sort of surface gloss and fantasy in the better Bond novels is actually more thoughtful. Mm. And the interesting thing, I mean, let's say, I think that From Russia with Love is Fleming's best novel and the most realistic. But actually, when you look closely at the Bond novels, you know, Bond is actually sometimes quite an inefficient and unsuccessful spy.
Yeah.
It's not all fantastic acts of daring do. Of course, the films have taken that and turned it into something entirely different. But in Fleming's novels, Bond often makes mistakes. There's often malfunctions in the security services. So to a certain extent, his own experience of working in SIS during World War II had shown him that not everything goes swimmingly well, and he does reflect that. But of course, the myth of Bond has overtaken these details, and he is the great English hero, even though he's not even English. He's half Scottish, half Swiss. But it's there to be discovered, but it's pretty well buried.
And have you seen Spectre yet? Were you at the screen last night?
Not yet. I may well take it in at some stage, because I'm a great fan of Daniel Craig, and so I have to see what his latest work is like.
And finally, this is sort of totally off topic, but I can't resist asking you about your time at the New Statesman in the early 80s, because you were our TV critic, weren't you?
Yes, I was TV critic of New Statesman for 2 years almost in the 80s, early 80s, 81 to 83 approximately. And it was an interesting time. Martin Amis had just left as literary editor, and I took over the job of TV critic from Julian Barnes. Craig Rain was the poetry editor. James Fenton was still writing the odd piece. Christopher Hitchens was around. So it was, in a way, an amazing moment to come into the Statesman. And it was a magazine that, as a student, I read with an avidity which I have never really reproduced since. It was the must-read weekly, and it had this incredible cast of writers and regular reviewers like Blake Morrison and Jeremy Treglown and so on, people who rose up the greasy pole of the literary establishment, but were all writing for the New Statesman in the late 70s and the early 80s. So it was a great time to be in the magazine. But times have changed, and there's no way that those days could be reproduced today. But it was a kind of seat of your pants. Get your copy in at the last. I was living in Oxford, and I used to jump on the train and deliver my copy by hand. That just shows you how old fashioned the whole thing was.
So, who was your editor there?
Gillian Wilkes was doing your job, Tom, and she had taken over from Martin. But there was a new editor at the time, an Australian called Bruce Page, and actually he quite radically transformed the magazine. He was far more interested in politics, and so the front half of the paper of the magazine became, as it were, more important. And the back pages, which were fantastic, almost unrivaled in their kind of literary fizz and sparkle, sort of suffered a bit under Bruce Page's editorship. All magazines or newspapers go through cycles, but it was a great cycle to be part of it. I really enjoyed my 2 years, but I'll never write a column again, I have to say.
Oh, really?
Utterly knackered.
Exhausted.
I did get a very early video recorder out of the job. So, it seems like ancient history, but it was fun as well. And there was a great crowd of people to work with. So, as you can imagine.
Wonderful. Well, thanks very much. Thanks very much for joining us, Will.
Great. And I'm glad I'm still writing for the magazine.
Yeah, well, I should say I'm probably contractually obliged to say that, of course, it goes without saying that the New Statesman is entering a great second, or fourth or fifth golden age.
I think it is.
Thanks very much, Will.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.